Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, nor the CIA have found any evidence that Iran has made a decision to build a bomb. Nonetheless, Israel has been conducting a campaign of assassinations and attacked on Iran with a view to producing regime change there and crippling the ability of the Iranians to enrich uranium, which they are doing, and they are clearly headed for some kind of nuclear latency, the ability to build a bomb on short notice if that becomes necessary, and they make that decision. But apparently they haven't made that decision. Everything that Israel is doing and the United States is threatening pushes Iran in the direction of making the very decision that we want them not to make.
Is the United States, in your view, Ambassador Freeman, preparing for war against Iran? Would probably be an unlawful, undeclared war. That doesn't seem to deter the modern presidency.
Well, there's a lot of evidence of deployments in the direction of the Persian Gulf. There are the threats that have been made by our president and others. In a way, the attacks on the Houthis seem designed to be a warning to Iran that we might join Israel in attacking it. And, of course, the reality is that the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, has had for decades a major effort to enlist us in a war on Iran that would consolidate Israeli supremacy in West Asia. So if I were Iranian, I would take the prospect of an attack by the United States very seriously, and apparently they are taking it seriously. And they are redoubling their relationship with the Russians in particular in support of their defense.
What do you think the Kremlin will do if American B-52s show up over Tehran?
Well, I don't think there's no alliance per se between Moscow and Tehran. So I think the Russian response would be quite cautious. The Russians are very much focused on, at the moment, on Ukraine and European security, less so on West Asia, as they showed when they were willing to abandon their protege, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria. So I think the response would be material support rather than a direct response against the United States. But I have to say that such an attack would really do incredible damage to our reputation internationally. An undeclared war, as you said, well, apparently we no longer pay attention to the constitutional provisions under which we're theoretically governed. But internationally, this would be seen as an unprovoked assault on a major country aimed at consolidating Israeli supremacy in a sea of Arabs and Muslims. It would really consolidate the emerging detestation of us by much of the world.
Which is the greater threat to peace and stability in the Middle East, Iran or Israel?
No question that Israel has a record of constantly starting wars, killing enormous numbers of people, conducting genocide. Iran has never attacked anybody. It was attacked by Iraq under Saddam Hussein, very likely at our urging. That is to say, we told the Iraqis that we would have their back if they punished Iran for its Islamic revolution and the hostage-taking of our diplomats that the students there conducted. But Iran itself has never attacked anybody, and not for 200 years.
How do you think President Trump's efforts to reset the relationship between the United States and Russia and his wish that it be global in scope and include China, India, Brazil, and others as well, will be affected by an American military support of an attack on Iran? I mean, would Vladimir Putin keep talking to Donald Trump if that were to happen?
Oh, I suspect he would keep talking because We are the only country that I know of, until recently, we were the only country that I knew of, that considers not talking to be a useful form of diplomacy. You know, the British...
Well, that was when we had the worst Secretary of State in the modern era.
Well, that's right. But, you know, I mean, of course, I recall a remark by President Nixon, with which I agree. He said, it's not always better to talk than not to talk. It depends if you on whether you know what you're going to say. And I would argue that that the most important thing is not talking, it's listening, which we also haven't done.
Okay, let me rephrase my question. Would an American military support of an Israeli attack on Tehran impair American-Russian relationships?
It would affect them very negatively, because it would appear to demonstrate that that we are prepared to bully and use force as a substitute for diplomacy, and that will discredit diplomacy. I mean, the Russians are already very suspicious of us because of our breaking pledges that we made to them about not expanding NATO to the east, because of our abrogation of treaties in the arms control area and other things in which they think they have been deceived by us. I think this would really bring that to a point of no return.
Let me go back to the group chat that was released to the editor of The Atlantic. There are people sitting in federal prisons who've released less information and information less classified than this. I can think of that 23-year-old airman from your neck of the woods, from Cape Cod. I don't even remember his name, but he's in jail for 20 years for revealing something less critical and timely than what was revealed. How serious is this, and do you expect anybody will be prosecuted?
Two different questions. On the first one, how serious it is, very clearly this discussion would have been available in real time to a number of countries with strong cyber espionage capabilities, including the Russians, the Chinese, very likely the Israelis. Therefore, the damage could have been enormous. Fortunately for us, Yemen doesn't have much air defense capability, so the risk of our pilots being shot down was less than it might have been. But this is a bad practice, and it makes us appear extraordinarily inept. It does not add to our reputation. On the question of whether anybody will be prosecuted, like Mr. Teixeira, the young airman that you mentioned from Massachusetts, that depends on the Justice Department, and the Justice Department does not appear to be exercising an independent role at present.
This is what happens when you don't have any independence at the FBI or the DOJ. This type of behavior can just summarily be overlooked. Whereas, and thank you and thank Chris for reminding me on his name, what Jack Teixeira did and didn't harm a soul resulted in a 20-year prison sentence. Finally, Ambassador, over the weekend, the Gaza Health Ministry announced that the 50,000th Gazan body had been buried as a result of the IDF slaughter in Gaza. The number is probably much larger because there are probably many bodies that haven't been discovered. And as horrific as the number is, you can't even get your hands around it. This is more people than can fit in Yankee Stadium. There didn't seem to be, it didn't seem to faze people, this number. There didn't seem to be the outrage you would expect. What is becoming of us that we're no longer outraged at death of this enormity?
Well, we have bought on to the dehumanization of the Palestinians, which has been a major public diplomacy or propaganda objective of the Israelis, and we're numbed. We just don't react. If I can go back to your earlier question, it seems to me that one of the great ironies in the situation where the participants in this classified conversation over cell phones will not be prosecuted. One of the great ironies is that this is precisely the kind of thing that Americans resented so much that they supported Donald Trump. That is in the election. That is to say, there's a group of people in our country who think they are exempt from the law. They're above the law. They can do what they want. This was the argument against Hillary Clinton, that she was arrogant and that she was exempt from the law. And now we see exactly this phenomenon carried out again in the new Trump administration. I find this incredibly ironic.
Well, Ambassador, thank you for your time and for your observations. There was always a lot for us to talk about, and you were very generous and gracious to allow me to go from one subject to the next.
Keep well.
Thank you, Ambassador.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Iran's pivotal role in the fight against global terrorism and its broader contributions to global stability are often misunderstood and even manipulated in international discourse, particularly in Western media. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, while the Islamic Republic of Iran is frequently portrayed in a negative light, its efforts to combat terrorism, support regional stability, and contribute to global peace have been significant. Iran's role in curbing the spread of violent extremism, stabilizing volatile regions, and fostering diplomacy offers valuable resources for global counterterrorism efforts, providing notable benefits to the region and the world at large. One of the most significant aspects of Iran's contributions to global security is its consistent and active role in combating terrorism, particularly concerning groups like Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and other extremist terrorist organizations. These groups do not only pose a threat to West Asia, but also have global ramifications, affecting countries in Europe, North America, and beyond. Iran's strategic actions in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon have been crucial in preventing the expansion of transnational terrorist networks. In Iraq and Syria, where Daesh Takfiri terrorists once posed a major threat, Iran's military and intelligence presence was essential in dismantling the group. Cooperation between the Popular Mobilization Forces, PMF, and the Iraqi government played a key role in eradicating the terrorist organization and preventing its further expansion into the Europe and the U.S. Iran's direct military intervention in the fight against Daesh significantly reduced the group's ability to launch larger-scale attacks in other parts of the world, thereby enhancing global security. The potential resurgence of such terrorist organizations poses an ongoing threat not only to West Asia, but to global peace, making Iran's involvement a crucial factor in countering their reach. The European Union and the United States have also faced blowback from terrorist organizations that were initially created or supported by Western powers in West Asia, as former U.S. President Donald Trump previously admitted. These attacks underscore the dangers posed by radicalized elements. Iran's strategic role in preventing the spread of terrorism cannot be overstated. By actively countering terrorist organizations within the West Asia region, Iran has helped stem the flow of foreign mercenary fighters and limit the operational capabilities of groups that might target Europe or North America. By supporting local governments and resistance groups, Iran has also prevented these terrorist organizations from establishing strongholds where they could train and launch attacks against nations worldwide. Furthermore, Iran's extensive intelligence network, deeply embedded in the region, has provided valuable insights into terrorist movements and operations. This intelligence has been shared with international actors, including Europe, China, Russia, and others, further demonstrating Iran's crucial role in counterterrorism efforts. Despite the strained diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran, intelligence cooperation has undeniably contributed to greater global security, particularly in Europe, where the risk of terrorism remains high. Iran's approach to combating terrorism and promoting stability stands in stark contrast to the policies of some Western nations. The United States and European powers have frequently relied on military interventions to address terrorism and regional instability, often resulting in prolonged conflicts and unintended consequences. The imposed wars on Iraq and Afghanistan, for example, led to significant loss of life, displacement, and regional instability, with effects that extended far beyond West Asia. In contrast, while Iran's approach is not without complexities, it has often focused on supporting local actors, providing intelligence, and engaging in diplomatic efforts. By avoiding direct military intervention in many cases, and instead offering strategic support to regional governments, Iran has contributed to a more sustainable approach to addressing terrorism and regional instability. Iran's contributions to global security extend beyond counterterrorism to include the fight against drug trafficking, a global threat with devastating consequences. According to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, approximately 271 million people worldwide used drugs in 2020, with opioids being the most harmful category. Afghanistan, which produces around 85% of the world's opium, serves as the epicenter of this crisis. From there, narcotics are smuggled through various routes, including the Balkan route and the southern route into Europe, Africa, and other parts of the world. Iran, sharing a long and porous border with Afghanistan and Pakistan, serves as a critical frontline defender in the global war on drug trafficking. Its strategic location makes it both a victim of the crisis and a key player in preventing the spread of narcotics. The impact of the illicit drug trade extends beyond Iran's borders, affecting global economies, destabilizing societies, and undermining development efforts. Iran's anti-drug efforts contribute significantly to international stability and security. These measures have proven effective in disrupting drug supply chains. For instance, Iranian authorities seize thousands of tons of narcotics annually, preventing them from reaching European and other international markets. In 2022 alone, Iran confiscated over 1.4 million kilograms of opiates and synthetic drugs, underscoring its pivotal role in global drug control efforts. The fight against drug trafficking has come at a tremendous human cost for Iran. Since the early 1980s, more than 4,000 Iranian law enforcement officers and military personnel have lost their lives while confronting armed drug traffickers. Thousands more have been injured in violent clashes with heavily armed smugglers determined to protect their illicit trade. These sacrifices highlight Iran's dedication to safeguarding not only its own citizens, but also the global community from the scourge of drug addiction. The financial burden of combating drug trafficking is equally staggering. Iran allocates substantial funds annually to securing its borders, training personnel, and acquiring the necessary equipment. Additionally, the indirect costs associated with treating drug addiction and addressing crime-related issues further strain economic resources. Despite these challenges, Iran remains steadfast in its resolve to eliminate drug trafficking from its territory and beyond. Despite the often unfair portrayal of Iran in Western media, its role in combating terrorism and promoting global stability should not be underestimated. Iran's direct engagement in the fight against groups like Daesh, its commitment to preventing the spread of terrorism to Europe and the U.S., and its diplomatic efforts to resolve conflicts make it a key player in global security. While political and ideological differences may persist, acknowledging Iran's contributions to counterterrorism and regional stability provides valuable insights that could benefit not only Europe and the United States, but the entire world.
Since Israel's invasion of Palestine and the occupation of the Jordan River cities, many religious scholars express concern over the development. The religious scholars of Cairo, Medina, Istanbul, Qom, and Najaf reacted differently to the occupation. Following these reactions, Arab nations and states described the occupation of Palestine as a national and ethnic issue, leading to the formation of a joint Arab front. In those years, socialist movements in Arab countries united under the Ba'ath Party. However, after successive defeats of the joint Arab front against Israel, the fervor gradually died down and the countries accepted the situation. Under these circumstances, the scholars of Najaf and Qom had a different reaction to the Zionist occupation. They framed the Palestinian issue as an Islamic one, considering Israel's existence and the continuation of its occupation as opposition to Islam. Among these scholars was Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri, the founder of the Qom Seminary School. Among them, we can mention Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, one of Ayatollah Burujerdi's students, and Sayyid Musa Sadr, one of Allama Tabatabai's students. In the years following the Arabs' defeat by Israel, as many surrendered to Israel in one way or another, the Shia scholars of Najaf and Qom initiated a new movement based on Islamic values, rather than just national, ethnic, or Arab views. Meanwhile, Arab countries, mainly governed by pan-Arab and Ba'athist ideologies, were engulfed in internal strife, pushing the Palestinian issue to the sidelines. In Iran, the Pahlavi regime was closely aligned with Israel, to the extent that Iran was often considered another Israel. However, the people in Iran and Iraq, contrary to their governments, opposed Israel. Amid continued disputes between Mossadegh and the Shah over the closure of the Iranian embassy in Israel, Imam Khomeini began his struggle against the pro-Israel regime. In mid-1953, while many sought an end to the Shah's rule to eliminate foreign influence, for others it marked the beginning of a new movement. When Sayyid Musa Sadr graduated from Tehran University in 1953 with a degree in economics and law, he took a different path, leaving for Lebanon, a region under Israeli control. In the years following the defeat of the United Arab Army in 1948, nationalist socialist movements emerged in regional countries, evolving into powerful forces. New governments under the Ba'ath Party banner took power in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, all united by a common vision to restore Arab dignity. This national, or rather ethnic, pride fostered a collective spirit and determination to stand against Israel. During this period of rising ethnic pride, Sayyid Musa Sadr was actively working in Beirut, Lebanon, addressing the needs of the less privileged areas. Lebanon faced more social disunity compared to other Arab countries due to its religious, intellectual, and ethnic diversity, which prevented the regional fervor from taking root. Through his efforts in meeting various people and offering support, Sayyid Musa Sadr became a unifying figure in Lebanon. He engaged in debates within Lebanese intellectual movements, reaching out to Shia and Sunni religious groups, and supported oppressed communities. While Arab countries have been preparing to confront Israel for years, progress was not as anticipated. Imam Khomeini launched his campaign against the Pahlavi regime in Iran having warned the Shah on numerous occasions through letters about the detrimental effects of American-Israeli policies. In June 1963, following his efforts to raise awareness through speeches, the Pahlavi regime decided to arrest Imam Khomeini and subsequently exiled him. The Shah believed that Imam Khomeini's movement was confined to Iran's borders and that exile would resolve the issue. However, Imam Khomeini's goal was broader, to awaken the people across the entire region under Shia religious authority. After the people in Arab countries and their military movements felt their national ethnic pride had been awakened, Israel launched a preemptive strike to prevent their forces from integrating. On January 5, 1967, Israel captured the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the Jordan River, the Sinai Desert, and the Golan Heights in just 6 days. Israel's territory expanded more than threefold in this short period. The Arabs, who had been preparing to confront Israel, were taken by surprise and found themselves in a weak position. Israel continued its advance, reaching within 40 kilometers of Damascus, which would have been a devastating blow to the United Arab Front. In response, Arab nations stood against Israel with all their might to mitigate the defeat. Iraq, coordinating with Egypt, reinforced forces in northern Syria to halt Israel's progress. Israel, having achieved significant success, did not engage in a war of attrition and set conditions for a peace deal that the joint Arab Front eventually agreed to under those terms. The defeat in the Six-Day War dealt a harder blow to the Arab nations. A few years passed since that war, and Arab countries decided to retaliate and restore their lost reputation. During those years, the Shah of Iran had been investing a substantial amount of money in Israel's reconstruction. In Israel's most critical situations, the Shah provided a glimmer of hope by supplying the regime with oil. By not supporting the Arab movement, he indirectly strengthened Israel in its fight against the Arab states. Saturday, October 6, 1973. Syria from the north, followed by Egypt from the south, launched surprise attacks on Israel. Initially, the operation favored Syria and Egypt, but gradually, with foreign aid, Israel countered the Egyptian and Syrian armies on two fronts. The Egyptian army was surrounded by the Sinai Desert, and for the first time, Israel entered Egypt's main territory by crossing the west bank of the Nile. In the north, Israel penetrated deep into Syrian territory, with Israeli artillery striking the suburbs of Damascus. After days of intense conflict, on October 25, 1973, the battle finally ended with a UN resolution backed by the United States and the Soviet Union. However, the truce resulted in agreements that brought shame and silence for all Arab countries. During those years, Sayed Musa Saj had emerged as a prominent leader for the people of Lebanon, earning him the title of Imam Musa Saj. Imam Musa Saj began his influential activities soon after arriving in Lebanon. 2 years before the Yom Kippur War, another Iranian, Mostafa Chamran, joined him in Lebanon to help expand his efforts. Chamran, who had studied plasma physics and electromechanics in American universities, was an activist leading student movements in the U.S. against the Shah of Iran. His arrival in Lebanon and meeting with Imam Musa Saj prompted increasing monitoring by Iran's intelligence and security organization, SABAK, due to his proximity to Israel, the Shah's ally. Dr. Chamran's collaboration with Imam Musa Saj aimed to organize Lebanese youth, particularly the Shia minority, who were involved in Lebanon's complex and tribal political landscape. With Musasad's presence, they not only maintained structural integrity, but also acted with unity. Under the watchful eyes of Savak and Mossad, Sadr and Chamran gathered Lebanese Shia youths at Jebel Amel High School, where they provided technical and professional courses. These efforts fostered a strong relationship between the Lebanese youth, Dr. Chamran, and Imam Musa Sadr. The situation in Lebanon, with its predominantly Christian structure, kept the country somewhat distanced from the conflicts between Israel and the Arab nations. However, the presence of displaced Palestinians in Lebanese camps and the establishment of Palestinian resistance forces in Lebanon consistently generated tension in southern Lebanon. Imam Musa Sadr seized this opportunity to teach military principles to members of Amal. Israel posed a direct threat to the Lebanese people. While Lebanese Christian leaders had an unwritten agreement with Israel, the Lebanese Shias were rising from the ashes of Arab pride, not with Arab ideology, but with the concept of Islamic resistance against Israel. After the Camp David Accords and Egypt's withdrawal as one of Israel's most formidable enemies, the path was cleared for Israel to pursue its objectives. One of these goals was to dismantle Palestinian groups dreaming of confronting Israel and liberating Palestine. In the years following the Arab War, Palestinian resistance groups had formed, establishing their headquarters near the Israeli-occupied territories in southern Lebanon, perpetuating regional conflict and tension. A few years after the Yom Kippur War in 1978, and before the victory of the Iranian Revolution, the most serious clashes between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli army began. Lacking substantial power, Palestinian forces were quickly forced out of southern Lebanon by Israel. However, Israel was not satisfied. The mere existence of Palestinian resistance groups meant the Palestinian dream remained alive. To crush that dream, these groups needed to be eliminated, alongside the Israelis searching for their adversaries in Lebanon. The Pahlavi regime was also hunting its opponents in the region. Iran's intelligence and security organization, Savak, had a strategic cooperation with Israel's Mossad since its establishment. Training Savak forces in Israel by Mossad and exchanging intelligence were key aspects of this cooperation. According to Mossad documents, Savak conducted activities abroad to ensure Israel's security and control opposition to the regime in regional countries. These activities included gathering intelligence and espionage in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria. One of the most sensitive countries for both Savak and the Mossad was Lebanon. Therefore, Savak sought to prevent Lebanon's unification with Egypt, Iraq, and Syria by influencing its ethnic and religious communities, including Christians and Shias, from the early years. Savak's mission was to ease Israel's concerns about Lebanon. The relative security of Lebanon had consequences for the Pahlavi regime. The relative peace in Lebanon and the country's non-interference in the Arab alliance against Israel made Lebanon a fertile ground for organizing and equipping Pahlavi opposition groups. Lebanon was a target for both Savak and Mossad in a deal where they supported each other. Mossad assisted Savak with training, equipment, and intelligence. However, these conditions gradually became more challenging for Savak, especially after an Iranian guest, well known by Savak forces, and the former head of Savak, Taimur Bakhtiar, went to Lebanon. After the coup on August 19, 1952, and the establishment of Savak, Taimur Bakhtiar was appointed as its first head. In the early years, organizing Iran's security situation, which still had significant opposition to the Shah and support for Mossadegh, or the Tudeh party, highlighted the importance of Bakhtiar's role in Savak. However, the longer Bakhtiar remained in his position, the more he became aware of the Pahlavi regime's corruption. In February 1961, when Bakhtiar was tasked by the Shah to deliver a message to John F. Kennedy, Kennedy's conversation with Bakhtiar about U.S. concerns over the corruption and inefficiency of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's rule angered the Shah. Upset that Kennedy had shared these concerns with Bakhtiar, the Shah removed him from Savak within a month. Bakhtiar stayed in Iran for a few months, but his alignment with those opposing the Pahlavi regime was unacceptable to the Shah. Consequently, Bakhtiar was exiled a year later. Exile did not improve the situation. Bakhtiar openly expressed his opposition to the Shah and the ruling regime in West Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. Savak reports indicated that Bakhtiar was constantly under surveillance by Savak agents, who even accused him of an assassination attempt on the Shah. Additionally, Bakhtiar's frequent trips to Lebanon and his relationship with Imam Musa Sadr were major concerns for the Shah and Savak. During those years, Savak and the Shah made several attempts to influence the Amal movement by praising Chamran and Imam Musa Sadr, but these efforts failed. The Shah and Savak were aware of Imam Musa Sadr's influence in Lebanon, a concern shared by Israel, which had tasked Iran with controlling the Amal movement. However, the situation continued to deteriorate. On April 12, 1968, Taimur Bakhtiar visited Lebanon, as he had done on previous occasions. This time, however, he was arrested by Lebanese forces. The Shah, attempting to secure Bakhtiar's return, offered several million dollars in bribes to the Lebanese authorities and promised a special plane for his transfer under complete control. Despite these efforts, the Lebanese authorities refused to hand over Bakhtiar. Imam Musa Sadr intervened, asking the Lebanese authorities to release Bakhtiar, and his mediation led to Bakhtiar's eventual release. The Shah's attempt to arrest Bakhtiar and establish a successful relationship with Imam Musa Sadr and Chamran had failed. More importantly, Savak and Mossad were concerned about Imam Musa Sadr's growing influence among various Lebanese communities. With Sadr's power increasing, Israel had no choice but to kidnap Imam Musa Sadr. On August 31, 1978, Imam Musa Sadr traveled to Libya at the invitation of Muammar Gaddafi. After that trip, no one saw Imam Musa Sadr again. The Lebanese authorities pursued the matter, but Gaddafi claimed that Imam Musa Sadr had left Libya for Rome, a claim Italy immediately refuted. Despite frequent discussions, Lebanon was ultimately deprived of Imam Musa Sadr. A few months later, the Iranian Revolution would overthrow the monarchical regime allied with Israel. In Imam Musa Sadr's absence, the youth of Amal had only one hope, Dr. Chamran. However, with the victory of the Iranian Revolution, Chamran returned to Iran to serve his homeland, for which he had tirelessly worked to liberate. Upon Chamran's arrival in Iran, Amal's youths followed, utilizing their experiences from Lebanon to establish the headquarters of irregular warfare. The bond between Iran and Lebanon was stronger than Israel could have imagined. The roots cultivated over years under the shadow of Mossad and Savak had emerged. Consequently, Israel concluded that its survival depended on an attack on Lebanon to achieve its objectives there. January 6, 1982. As Iran and Iraq were deeply engaged in a war, Israel entered Lebanon under the pretext of combating Palestinian resistance movements. Israel occupied the Shia areas in southern Lebanon, resulting in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. The Maronite Christian forces, known as the Phalanx, aligned with Israel, making Lebanon unsafe for Shias and Palestinian resistance forces in the northern regions. The Amal movement forces emerged as the sole protectors of the Lebanese in this dire situation. Urban warfare had been raging in Lebanon for several months. Meanwhile, Iran was focused on fighting and recapturing its cities. These efforts culminated on May 24, 1982, with the liberation of Khorramshahr, Iran's most significant fallen city, which had become a symbol of resistance. After reclaiming Khorramshahr, Iranian forces began to concentrate their efforts beyond their borders, with Lebanon becoming a new focal point for them. June 13, 1982, Iran, in coordination with the Supreme Council of Defense, sent forces from the Mohammad Rasulullah Brigade under the command of Ahmad Mutawassilian to Lebanon. The brigade's mission was to assist Lebanese forces and fight against Israel. Initially, the Iranian forces were deployed to Damascus and then transferred to Lebanon via land routes. A few days after their arrival, Imam Khomeini became aware of their presence and, prioritizing the Iranian fronts, ordered their return to Iran. Consequently, the Mohammad Rasulullah Brigade returned to Iran and was stationed on Iran's fronts. However, Ahmad Mutawassilian and several other commanders remained in Lebanon to complete their mission. Mutawassilian, one of the most experienced Iranian commanders, had extensive combat experience from the war in Iran's Kurdistan against the so-called Democratic Party, making him adept at leading urban warfare and organizing forces. These capabilities had gone unnoticed by Israel. The presence of such a commander in Lebanon was concerning for Israel. With no news of Imam Musa Sadr and Dr. Chamran, Ahmad Mutawassilian established a new line of resistance in Lebanon. July 4, 1982. A meeting was held at the Iranian embassy in Beirut to evaluate the activities and achievements of Ahmad Mutawassilian and the Mohammad Rasulullah Brigade in Lebanon. It was decided that all remaining groups of Iranian troops in Lebanon would travel to Damascus on July 6th and return to Iran. Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, the chargé d'affaires of the Iranian embassy, suggested that before returning, they could visit Baalbek and the suburbs of Beirut to inspect the region and prepare a report. On the morning of July 5, 1982, Ahmad Mutawassilian, Iranian diplomat Mousavi, and two Iranian journalists, Taghir Astigar Mughaddam and Kazem Akhavan, were heading to the outskirts of Beirut. On their way to a checkpoint, they encountered Falange forces, who were waiting for them. This was the last known information about the passengers of the Iranian diplomatic car in Lebanon. After that, no one heard from them again, similar to what had happened with Imam Musa Sadr. The movement formed by the presence of Iranian forces in Lebanon would soon reshape relations between Lebanon and the region. A new force would be established in Lebanon, which would not only become a significant chapter for Lebanese movements like Amal, but also open a new chapter in the confrontation with Israel.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment, we'll be talking about famous reciters of the Quran in the world of Islam. Today, we're going to be talking about Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar. Iranians very much like this reciter, especially those who are fans of Quran recitation. He first visited Iran in the 1990s, and he was warmly received by all Iranians. This great reciter was born in 1950 in the Qahliya Governorate of Egypt. He memorized the Quran at an early age and then learned the rules of tajweed and other sciences pertaining to the recitation of the Quran. There were other reciters in this region who Sheikh Shahat Anwar was very much influenced by them, especially Sheikh Abdus-Samad Az-Zanati. This reciter influenced Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar the most. And of course, another reciter was Sheikh Hamdi Zamil. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar quickly became a very talented reciter. He had a very beautiful voice, a very good voice, and he became famous all over Egypt and all over the world. He visited Iran several times. The first time that he visited Iran, he recited the Quran in different cities of Iran. One of his best recitations was in Mashhad, the place where Sheikh Shahat Anwar had called the center of Quran recitation in the world after Egypt. He recited Surah Al-Ma'idah, verses 114 to 115 in Mashhad. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar has three sons. His first son and his third son, his eldest son and his third son, who are Sheikh Anwar Shahat and Sheikh Mahmoud Shahat, respectively, are both very good reciters of the Quran. And they visit Iran occasionally to recite the Quran. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar had told his sons, these two sons of his, that when you go to Iran, make sure that you recite the Quran well. Make sure that you care about Iran. And that is what we see when we look at the recitations of Sheikh Anwar Shahat and Sheikh Mahmoud Shahat. We see that they recite the Quran very well when they come to Iran. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, in his late 40s or early 40s, he contracted a disease which was, he couldn't recite the Quran anymore. It was a disease of the larynx. And he couldn't recite the Quran anymore. And in the year 2008, at the age of 58, Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar passed away. May Allah bless this reciter and elevate his ranks. With this introduction, let's listen to Surah Al-Ma'idah, verses 114 to 115 by Sheikh Shahat Anwar, which was performed in Mashhad. Let's enjoy this recitation.
Allah Said Jesus, the Son of Mary, O Allah, our Lord, send down to us a table spread with food from the heaven, to be for us a festival for the first of us and the last of us, and a sign from you. And provide for us, and you are the best of providers. Allah said, Indeed, I will send it down to you. But whoever disbelieves afterwards from among you, then indeed will I punish him with a punishment by which I have not punished anyone among the worlds.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Amid the devastation and despair, the people of Gaza have faced relentless bombardment, starvation, and displacement. Yet through this enduring crisis, one thing has remained unshaken in their collective spirit, their unwavering commitment to their lawful right of resistance.
After nearly 18 months of genocide, the people of Gaza have taken to the streets in an uprising against